We'll get started.
Joined.
Lisa.
Joined.
Lex.
Joined.
Kelsey, I just want to let you know that I'll probably be ducking out about 3:50. I have another call at 4.
Okay, thank you so much.
Melanie?
Joined.
Okay, well, I think we can get started. I'm sure we'll have a few more attendees joining us. If you're able to, we'd love for you to type into the chat box just your name and those who are with you in attendance.
Diana Brescher.
Join.
Webinar. We know that some of you have multiple people in the room potentially listening into today's session. And alternatively, if you'd like to just send me an email, the list of participants on your end that are engaging in the webinar today, you can do that as well. I'll put my email into the chat box, but it's leonardkt@upmc.edu. We're thrilled today to welcome Gigi Crowder to
join
and on mental health friendly communities and really looking predominantly at our faith-based outreach that we do within the Pennsylvania System of Care. We're thrilled to have her because this really is the epitome of what we call
Kathy and Alyssa, Montgomery County.
And
join.
Giving you an example of what this looks like on the ground and with a tangential experience. So I'd like to start by introducing Gigi and letting you get to know a little bit about her through her bio. And then the rest of the agenda for today is I will then switch us over to our GoToMeeting screen and we'll check in to make sure that we have all of the technology up and running for that. And learn a little bit about interfaith learning agreements, and then I'll transfer the presentation over to Gigi to do the PowerPoint, and then we have a few other agenda items towards the end on how you can engage around mental health-friendly communities for the month of May and mental health awareness. So, to start, Gigi Crowder is a native of Oakland, California. She is the mother of two biological children, 24-year-old twin boys, and has served as a foster mom and mentor to many more through divine interventions. Gigi is the Ethnic Services Manager for Alameda County Behavioral Healthcare Services and has worked in the behavioral healthcare field for more than 28 years after completing her studies at the University of California, Berkeley. She's also a family member of several loved ones who have received both private and public mental health services. She's a strong advocate for promoting culturally responsive behavioral health services for all clients, consumers, and family members. Additionally, Gigi is committed to promoting the use of community-defined strategies for unserved, underserved, and inappropriately served ethnic and
Wendy
cultural
communities. Joined.
Her current focus is addressing the needs of at-promise African-American males by utilizing upstream approaches such as mentoring and the resources offered in faith spirituality communities. She is a pioneer in the area of developing curriculum to train faith leaders to better support those with mental health challenges and their families and loved ones. Additionally, Gigi serves in leadership roles on several statewide committees. One of the highlights of her career has been was being inducted into the Alameda County Women Hall of Fame for her work in the developing programs to enhance employment opportunities for individuals with psychiatric challenges, and most recently receiving the 2013 Mental Health Association of Alameda County Mental Health Achievement Award. Gigi believes when a man or woman has the conviction that he or she is doing the work God gave him or her to do, there is a zeal and a courage in his or her soul that all the forces of this world cannot destroy. So as you can tell from her fantastic bio, we're just so thrilled to have her. Gigi, I will turn the screen over to the Interfaith Learning Agreements and allow you to do any further introductions you may have.
Great. Thanks so much. I am really excited to be here. We started a communication maybe over a year ago, and I'm really always excited when I hear that there's other jurisdictions outside of my home state, California, doing this work, because we recognize that when individuals are in any kind of crisis or stress, they first turn to their faith communities for support. So because of my role as the Ethnic Services Manager, Cultural Responsiveness Coordinator, I look for opportunities to advance my work and be as responsive to the communities that we serve in Alameda County as possible. At this point, we're deemed as being one of the most diverse counties in the nation. And so I always look for individuals who would be referred to as the cultural brokers for our community. If you want to talk to my community, you must first be vetted through this individual. And when I did that, I often was referred to a faith leader. So when I started doing work with larger groups of individuals, it was really important that we had a tool that we can bring large numbers of individuals together and we could all be on the same page promoting mental wellness for all from many different walks of life with many different spiritual practices. So what you should be seeing now is the Interfaith Learning Agreement. And the Learning Agreement was modified by a dear friend of mine, Dr. Matthew Mock, who took a tool that was already in place and kind of shifted over to be more responsive to faith community. So the very first, and it spells out respect, and that's also where the word responsiveness comes from. When I first started doing this work, I was seeing a lot of cultural competence, must be competent. And what I was hearing from community members was, I just need you to be responsive to me, meaning if I have something important and I want to share it with you, you don't have to have all the answers, but you should be responding to my needs. So the very first word is respect, so respect for others' beliefs. When we have gatherings, we want everyone to come together with a respect for others' beliefs, recognizing that we come from various diverse backgrounds and life experiences. Then we want to engage respectfully. That each of us agrees to fully listen to the other for the entire content and will receive the same acknowledgement from others. Enjoy the gifts of our religious and spiritual diversity, meaning that individuals come from various backgrounds, but they all bring gifts. And when doing this work, I've been in rooms with individuals who've been up to 30 different faith or religious practices, but we all quickly learned early on that we often share more similarities than differences. We should all be able to share equal participation. This means checking in with others who are more silent. More importantly, to also check in with ourselves if we're talking too much. That's something that I have been working on, continue to. We should strive to be PC, and rather than remain safe and politically correct, for our definition, PC means to be personally compassionate. That means to stretch oneself and engage in a more meaningful understanding of being with others in a safe space. We should be able to participate with mindfulness, being deeply aware of what's going on within us and around us through our hearts, minds, bodies, spirits, and souls. We should each strive to be genuine and authentic during our time together. We will strive to be aware of intention and resulting consequences. Providing amnesty and forgiveness in order to repair or correct misinformation, there must be opportunities to acknowledge mistakes, faulty assumptions, and actions which may be unintentionally painful to others. So we started off with a word called cultural competence, then we moved to being culturally responsive, and now if we're getting this work done well, when we do this type of work, we're operating in cultural humility, and that's what's really important. The E is for engage in dialogue versus debate. We should each work to listen and encourage our perspectives and ideas. We will work in partnership without having to determine who is right or wrong, the winner or the loser, and without proselytizing. Very important. Confidentiality. Information shared in the room stays within the room and the learning session. People share in our spirituality work groups that we hold monthly in Alameda County a lot of really personal information, and it's real important to create a safe space so when someone is sharing, they won't have to have that their share come up in another environment that might be harmful to them. So we can share our general learning with others, but not be specific about comments that would violate the privacy of others. And then transformation.
Josh Kidd.
We will allow others to be transformed by our interactions and the sharing of our stories. So a big part of the work I do, actually, I try to make it very available to all individuals, and I do so by working really hard to make sure that the most important voice lifted up is that of the individual with lived experience. So my lived experience has come by way of working in the county system and seeing the great need, especially for those with from unserved, underserved, and inappropriately served communities. I've always been able to identify individuals from those communities receiving our services, whether a family member or a person who lives with the diagnosis of a mental health challenge. And our department is mandated to work with those who work with the most severe mental health challenges. So I've been able to connect with those individuals in a way of hearing their stories. In some faith communities, the whole notion that we have evidence-based practices that say sharing your story is important, some of what has sustained some faith communities, and they use a different terminology, is they share their testimonies. And so that really has been important. And so for the training that I do, I generally operate with myself, with the county lens, and then I always have someone there who's a faith leader to work alongside.
Joined.
As well as a person who has personal lived experience or is a family member. So sitting at my desk when I started, as I shared, I was looking for ways to improve the health outcomes for these vulnerable community members and was introduced to cultural brokers, and I quickly found out a lot of the cultural brokers didn't even know there was an office like mine that existed, where my job was to ensure that the services were fair and equitable for all of our community members, and they had very little knowledge around mental health. At the same time, once I started doing the trainings, a lot of the faith leaders from all the different backgrounds acknowledged that they had been doing a lot of the work supporting individuals, family members, those with lived experience themselves, and not doing it in a way that necessarily honored the individual. So as we turn to what I wanted to share with you today is the building mental health friendly communities. And for this particular project, I was funded in California to do it specific to the African American community. So the terminology you see here is building mental health friendly communities one congregation at a time. That could be one parish at a time. That could be whatever is applicable for the community in which you're working with.
Gigi, would you like me to transfer the screen now for your
PowerPoint? Oh, yeah, I thought I was prompting you when I
said that. No, that was perfect. Okay.
That's okay. I had that first page was, yes, the title page, and then as I shared, I was working with the African American faith community, so for that community, the church needs to be a caring community. If individuals are first turning there, when they live with mental health challenges and are going there for support, we must make it a caring, welcoming community. And I quickly found out that that wasn't always the case. So a lot of people who live with mental health challenges carry a deep connection with their faith practice but do not feel necessarily welcome when they go into the faith community. And our job is to partner with each of these communities so that they can be more welcoming and nurturing when individuals show up wanting that level of support. The faith community can be a catalyst for change. It says a long history of being leading efforts around social change as with the civil rights movement, many movements that follow that, whether it's women's rights or more recent opportunities to advance efforts have often been led by the faith community. So faith leaders have an incredible power to deliver messages of hope to marginalized and disenfranchised individuals because they offer hope. So a lot of times when people ask me what type of work I do, I say a lot of my work is in it's not necessarily faith-based, but it's hope-based because what it represents for the individuals that we work with is hope. Community members look to the faith and spiritual community and its leadership in time of distress for support. So as working in Alameda County, what kind of pressed on me to finally stop carrying information that I knew and put it into practice was a very hard situation that I had to live through when a young man from my county who I knew was going to one of our wellness centers and really struggling went to his faith leader, shared how he was feeling hopeless, and the faith leader did his best to soothe and comfort the individuals but did not see the signs that the individual was in a somewhat of a suicidal state and had suicidal ideation. So the young man went home and ended not just his life but his family member's life. And that's when I knew that I needed to do more than just talk about training faith leaders, but I really needed to put it into practice by coming up with a curriculum, and that birthed the Mental Health Friendly Communities model. So, me carrying the information alone in my county, but knowing there was other like-minded individuals who also understood that there was an important role that faith and spirituality plays for individuals, we in California started a statewide mental health and spirituality initiative, and we started it with like-minded individuals, and we reached out to individuals from very diverse backgrounds. And you can go to our website. I should have included it here. I failed to do that. But it's www.mhspirit.org. And we have a wealth of resources and background information. But what we wanted to make sure happened to kind of get the buy-in from our California behavioral health directors was we wanted to do a survey and gauge from them what they thought was the important the importance of mental wellness as a recovery tool for individuals who live with severe mental health challenges and those who are family members who support those individuals. So when we did our survey, we found that 90% of the California's county behavioral health directors responded that they strongly agree that mental health and spirituality are closely connected and should be incorporated into discussions. 92% felt like spirituality is an important recovery resource in mental health treatment. There's an understanding for JACO, which monitors inpatient settings, that a question is asked upon intake if an individual wants to identify and include their faith practice in their intake information. We do not do that in outpatient, but that's one of the things that we'd like to see happen because in California we recognize for a lot of the individuals we serve, when they go in and they do an intake, if they're not able to share who they are holistically, completely, they're leaving, for a lot of individuals, a big part of who they are behind in the conversation. So it was really important for us to also recognize, and 94% of our directors recognize that spirituality is an important wellness, a prevention tool for individuals, them having an opportunity to have preventative programs that are culturally responsive in place help them maintain their mental wellness. And we also found that in working with multicultural communities that incorporating spirituality is an important element for achieving multicultural competency for mental health providers. So I'll talk a little later about the training that we do for each of these groups, but really important if individuals felt that way, that they have an opportunity to work with their case managers, providers, therapists around the work. I heard stories of individuals saying how they were really disappointed that when they get to that part of closeness with their therapist or case manager and they say, well, you know, something that's really important to me is my faith practice, my spiritual practice, and we all, well, I know I am because I know how old I am, were trained to avoid that part of the conversation when it came up. So a lot of times individuals were starting to make progress, and then they would share that their faith spiritual practice was important to them, and then the conversation would shift to things like, well, let's now explore your medication options. And that was very hard for some of the consumers that we were working with. So we also wanted to do a consumer and family member survey. And we had quite a few individuals. We had over 2,600 individuals who responded. Of the 2,600, 88% of the African-American mental health consumers and family members across California reported that spirituality was important to them. So that was the highest of the cultural communities. And in California, we operate by looking at threshold languages, and it was a big win for us that we were able to get all of our threshold languages translated to get as wide a sampling from a wide variety of cultural and ethnic communities. So the group that came in second to African Americans was the Chinese Americans, saying that faith and spirituality was also important to them. However, they said that it's really embedded. It's not like something that's over there. It's much more embedded into their culture and not separate. 72% reported that they believe it's appropriate. So this is coming from the consumer and family members, that it's appropriate for public mental health care to address spirituality as a part of mental health care. So when I first started doing this work and even talking about it, I used to have individuals who would sit with their arms crossed and they would kind of have a look of, ooh, should we even be talking about this? Now here in California, it's pretty widely accepted, and so even family members and consumers who wanted to talk about it but felt like we possibly should not be because of this myth around separation of church and state, they now are very open. And in California, I facilitate a conference call for all the counties once a month, and at this point with 58 counties, probably 90% of them have participated at some point, and they share monthly all the activities that they have in place. And then 89% of the individuals that we surveyed reported that they regularly use prayer as a wellness tool. So that was also very significant for the consumers and the family members. So in our mental health-friendly communities model, we wanted to make sure that we uplifted the cultural pieces as much as possible. And mental health-friendly communities is a culturally responsive community-defined strategy. So I didn't just sit at my desk and decide that this was the way to advance efforts for any community. It was already being done in a lot of ways, and it just needed to be put on paper. And so we know that when we're doing work through the mental health friendly communities model, we are addressing health disparities that are associated with mental illness, and that in order to address the stigma and the discrimination that individuals live with who live with mental health challenges, we look at each of the ethnic communities, and we look at some of the disparities that exist for them. One really well-known and documented disparity is that for the African-American community, too often individuals have their first contact with criminal justice, and some live a lifetime of having mental health and never get treatment, but they get services in the criminal justice mental health setting. And many of those individuals that we went in and worked with said what kept them going was their faith practice when they're in that setting, even when they're in the most decompensated state, and how important having a chaplain in an inpatient criminal justice setting is for individuals. We also wanted to create this, too, because we wanted to replace the misinformation about mental health with accurate information. So when I started doing this work, I knew it was important to bring together clergy members. So we had a clergy roundtable where we brought all the clergy together. We asked the question, if individuals indeed are first turning to their faith communities when in distress, what type of problems are they bringing and how are the faith leaders responding? And unfortunately, we found out that in most faith communities, there is a lot of stigmatizing messages that come across the podium or the pulpit, and that creates barriers to wellness. So one of the things that we'll get to later on is the 10 commitments that we ask faith leaders to make so that they're not stigmatizing and they're not hurting family members who are there with their loved one and hearing things that are not people first. We also wanted to support the ultimate goal was to offer support for individuals and their families who live with mental health concerns. So one of the products of building a mental health friendly community is looking in the faith communities and the individuals that attend and seeing if there's an opportunity for mental health ministries to be birthed. Mental health ministries would be a place where there would be a person who lives with a mental health challenge who this is important to, a family member, the leadership from the lead faith leader, and others who may even work in the mental health field coming together so that when individuals are experiencing a difficult time, they can respond accordingly. And we help faith communities become resources for their community. So one of the things that's really special about the Catholic faith is that they have parishes, so they take care of not just the individuals who attend their faith community or their church, they also take care of the neighborhood. So that was the model that we were going with so that we could build up in every community a faith center where individuals can go there and know that there would be resources and that the faith center would have opportunities to respond to issues that happen in the community, whether it be a death or grief counseling around a situation that might be traumatic for the whole community. And so that was one of the approaches. We also, in doing our surveys, found that consumers and family members said that spirituality is important to them as well, and that faith leaders need to be trained and equipped with tools to recognize how to effectively support people and families living with mental health concerns. We also wanted to improve the outcomes that individuals experience and that were reported to us around having an opportunity to support individuals by including a mental health recovery-focused planning using their faith as a opportunity on their treatment plan. The picture that's in this slide is a group of individuals from diverse ethnic backgrounds who all are defined as cultural brokers for their communities, and we all came together in Los Angeles and made commitments around how we would support individuals who are more isolated to reach those communities, those who had language barriers, those who had been hurt in the past from their faith community. So we came up with a list of strategies to do that. In order for a faith community to be deemed as mental health friendly, and most of the work, as I shared earlier, was done in the African-American community, they have to go through distinct training modules. So just saying, oh, we embrace this work and we're going to be more mental health friendly is not enough. So too often I would go do trainings in faith centers, and if one of the leaders left and the leader was not committed as the former leader, then it would slip back into language that was not honoring. So we're going to get to looking at the 10 commitments, but I first want to show you the training. So we first have the mental health one-on-one, and that audience for that is really the faith leaders. And what we do with the mental health one-on-one, and it could be mental health one-on-one for African Americans, it could be mental health one-on-one for the API community, mental health one-on-one for the Latino Hispanic community, mental health one-on-one for Native Americans. What I do is remove myself, decrease myself whenever I'm working with another ethnic community and find cultural brokers for that community. So the individuals who showed up at the clergy roundtable who represent the API community, Asian Pacific Islander community, they would be the face for sharing the information. If I'm working with in an area where there's a large Jewish community and I've been asked to come out, I would pick the rabbi who I've worked with on this work, and they're going to be received much more readily than anyone else, and then we'll look for an individual with lived experience from those faith communities. But the whole idea is to broaden the competency of those faith and spiritual leaders as the first responders to mental health crisis and inspire those leaders to create welcoming communities. And so we go through the 5 most common diagnoses. And schizophrenia is usually on there, schizoaffective disorder, bipolar disorder. PTSD has come up a lot more now since we are more working in trauma-informed care systems and understanding what PTSD truly looks like for many of the individuals that we work with. And ADHD for younger individuals. And what we try and do is create scenarios around these diagnoses and how individuals might experience them in a faith community. What does a person who lives with schizophrenia, what are some of the things you might see in a faith setting, and how can you better support the individuals when they come versus having the individual be ostracized and not welcome? So and going through the diagnosis, we give the accurate information, and then we also go through some of the miscommunication, some of the ideas that individuals have. One of the more common misused words is schizophrenia when individuals are saying the person was acting schizo, and I try not to use terminology that's offensive to other individuals, but and the misunderstanding with that word and faith leaders using it and saying things over the pulpit like Jesus was not schizophrenic. He didn't say one thing and do another, and it's a total misuse of the word. So all of that type of education. I've had faith leaders, after taking the mental health 101 training, go back and apologize to their congregants and their parishioners, knowing that they have hurt a lot of people. And that's always rewarding when they're able to come back, humble themselves, and come back and share that they only took maybe one course in seminary on mental health or counseling, and that they really didn't have the skill set. And now they're going to try and do it better. The other training that's really important, and I touched upon it earlier, if we're training faith leaders to now be more responsive and have a better understanding so that they can support individuals who live with mental health challenges, then we also have to prepare our mental health system, because we're also asking those faith leaders to identify partnerships in the community, identify like-minded clinicians and therapists who also will support them. So it's important for us to do the spirituality one-on-one for mental health service providers to help them build their understanding around why faith and spirituality is so important for individuals, how it's a core wellness tool and an essential wellness tool for a lot of the individuals that we work with. So that focus includes resources, and we use a multicultural competency lens. I generally have used the NAMI toolkit for the ethnic communities, recognizing that these are broad categories. So if you have one for the African-American community, it doesn't mean all African-Americans. All African-Americans have the characteristics. If you're working with the API community, not all API, but just some general guidelines. And I think the first group of NAMI tools work as great, and the statistics didn't necessarily bear true for the ethnic communities they were representing, but I think the more recent ones have done a really good job of working with those ethnic communities to look at mental illness and how it impacts those communities. So we recognize in each one of those that each of them also, when NAMI did their services, and NAMI is the National Alliance for Mental Illness, that spirituality also was seen as a wellness tool for most. Language, of course, came up as barriers for some of those communities. But overall, how mental illness looks in certain communities and the cultural considerations, NAMI did a very good job with that. So we do that training for the providers, and it's an open dialogue, and we try and have a very safe environment for them. So although we use the cultural brokers from those faith communities to help support us, we set an environment using the Interfaith Learning Agreement to have the dialogue be delivered in a PC, personally compassionate manner, that allows for individuals who are providers to feel pretty safe about asking questions and questioning things, even separation of church and state issues. Recognize that most of us who do this work didn't include this into our approach and working. And then the keepers of the flock is coming from a scripture of the lost sheep, and that was the way that we created this curriculum, and it's pretty much for a general audience, and it's kind of an overview of the work of building mental health friendly communities. But we do use the scripture of the lost sheep to illustrate that the one lost sheep is just as valuable as all of the other 99 that were in the fold, and sometimes it may be that while that sheep was dealing with their mental health challenges and in a decompensated state, it was the responsibility of all, not just faith leaders, but for all in that community to go back and support that individual, because left alone, they're falling victim to the criminal justice system. They're falling victim to a lot of the really horrific things that happen to our individuals, consumers who live with mental health challenges when they're out there to fend on their own. So that one has been one that we've shared in a 3 to 4 hour setting when trying to illustrate the need for this work to go forth. And then the final training is adapted for each ethnic community. For the African-American community, we used the Bridge Over Troubled Water, and we provided the historical perspective of the role that faith fulfills within the experience of African Americans. From the slave ship to the White House, there was a deep core belief system around hope and faith that ran very deep for African Americans around staying connected so that there could be an opportunity for healing and maintaining personal and community wellness. So if we were doing it for the API community, it might be a different title, and it would still do the very same thing, work with those communities to identify historical things that have happened around their faith practice that have kept the majority of the community vetted in that particular faith. I did a training in the Latino-Hispanic community, and we were able to crosswalk the Catholic faith and hope and healing and support to why it's so important for individuals from that faith to carry with them principles that sustain them when they're in mental health crises. So one of the things that we've asked the churches that we work with to do is to create a committed team, and I spoke to the family member being important, the consumer being important, mental health allies, and the most important being the faith leader's commitment to doing the work. And so I think that I want to continue supporting you and your efforts there in Pennsylvania. Sounds like you're doing a lot of work by recognizing that to engage with ethnic and cultural communities, you probably do need to work with the faith community to do so. I want to share with you now the 10 commitments, if you can put that up.
Okay. Give us a second.
Okay,
you guys should be seeing the 10 commitments now.
And I don't actually have it in front of me, so I need to pull it up myself. Just a moment. It wasn't in that email. Well, the 10 commitments, I can talk while I'm doing this. The 10 commitments was just what needs to happen in faith communities in order for individuals to feel welcoming. So I'm going to ask if you, Kelsey, can read the first one for us.
Yes, of course. So the first one we have is it says, you know, it's a commitment from the pastor, leadership, and members of the church or faith-based community can insert their name there, and commit to our members and community to commit to eliminating mental health stigma, discrimination, and improving outcomes for consumers and family members of our congregation.
Thank you so much. And that would be our temple. That would be our, you know, faith community. So this one was specific to a project that I did. So we use the word pastor. We might say father. We might say rabbi. We might say archbishop. We're going to use whatever terminology represents that community. Then the second is to develop a mental health ministry. So often when I go to health fairs, which is a part of my job, I'll be asked to go to a health fair, and they'll have they more and more might have depression screening, but that's the closest you get to mental health usually. Usually you don't have that. You have high blood pressure, you have diabetic screening, but never mental health. And so we are asked to faith communities when they have health fairs and things like that to have it, and we're asking them to have a mental health ministry, meaning individuals now, faith leaders often now after the training recognize that they have congregants that do have mental health challenges. So that's the second one. Hosting regular mental wellness fireside chats for members in the community. So if something happens in the community that's been especially stressful and traumatic for individuals, you can respond to that, or you can just have fireside chats where you discuss issues around depression, suicide, et cetera, and get congregations to have a better idea. Hosting annual mental wellness training events, the Mental Health 101, the Spirituality 101, those are all very important. Recognizing and promoting the National Week of Prayer, that's what we ask.
Yes.
Be familiar with.
Just if everyone could mute their lines, we're getting a bit of feedback. Sorry, Gigi, I'll let you continue.
So we know that May is Mental Health Awareness Month, but in this country, the first full week of October is the National Mental Health Day Week of Prayer, and the first Tuesday of the full month week, the first full week in October is the National Day of Prayer for Mental Health. And we recognize all of that as well as May. And we utilize mental health friendly language, meaning I don't refer to people as their illness. We wouldn't see someone and say, oh, there's the cancer coming my way, so we shouldn't say here's the schizophrenic. We should say people first language in our teaching, in our preaching, and in our ministry. And so I've committed to when I hear someone saying something that's not people first to correcting them. And so the communities, the faith communities that we work with are also doing the same to honor the individual and not treat them. And there's a word that, there's many words in our vocabulary that don't honor being said, and I say the C word rather than the other word because of the misuse and how much pain it brings to individuals. We eliminate that word completely in the work that we do. And then we're asked our faith communities that we work with to dedicate at least two messages annually to mental wellness. when we started doing this work, we found out that a lot of the faith leaders thought they were kind of doing that. They might not name it mental wellness, and we just had to make sure that it was honoring and non-stigmatizing messages and that they continued with that process. Then we want all of our mental health friendly communities to foster, cultivate, and develop collaborative relationships with local like-minded organizations committed to promoting wellness and that. And for this case, it was the African-American communities, but like I said, it could have been the API, the Latino, any community where that needs to happen. And then incorporate, as I said earlier, the mental wellness training and church-wide events, retreats, and workshops. And because I was given an opportunity to work with the African-American community, and I last year in April, I was contacted by our state leaders around mental health. We in California have a fund, the Mental Health Services Act, where we fund, well, millionaires are committed to being taxed 1% of their income, and it goes into a fund just around mental health. And so there's a statewide campaign called Each Mind Matters, and I guess they may have had a little extra money, and they said, Gigi, can you lead an effort for the African-American community? So, Kelsey, if you can show, if you can pull up just that, the Each Mind Matters green ribbon campaign that I put together. We have green ribbons that we wear. That's the color around mental health awareness nationally. I think NAMI started it. And I was able to provide ribbons across our state, and we picked one weekend to make sure we were inclusive as possible for the African-American community, and we distributed the ribbons, and we distributed posters, and I identified videos where African-Americans were speaking about their experience living with mental health challenges and how their faith had been a wellness tool for them. And so I've been asked to do that again this year in May, and we're going to do it in May 20th. And this year, if I complete my task, I would be giving out 50,000 green ribbons. And I don't know that I'm going to even be able to do that, but I am going to make sure everyone who wants to be a part of it gets this handout with information on how they can be a part of it. And so in California, where I live, I'm referred to as the Green Ribbon Woman, and I see individuals, especially young transition-age youth, who have been given the ribbons, who are letting people know that they're having a difficult time because they're wearing the ribbon all the time. And suicide issues came up pretty heavily in the African-American community, so last year we aligned our staff with recognizing the signs around suicide prevention while we did this campaign. So I think my time is probably up, and I think Chelsea wants to have an opportunity for questions and answers.
Yes, that's perfect. Well, thank you so much. We you ended just right on time for us to allow for we have about 15 minutes, potentially longer, for some discussion questions. So we're happy to also return to any of the slides in the PowerPoint if you had questions about the specific trainings that they've put together. But yes, we welcome any questions, and feel free to just jump in on the line.
Hi, Gigi and everybody. This is Pat Cambry. I want to thank you for spending your time this afternoon and talking with us about all the great things you're doing. I'm wondering, with my question is, with your 101 mental health training, do you at any time use youth mental health first aid training or, you know, adult mental health first aid training?
I will share with you that when I first heard about mental health first aid, I was excited because I'm in a family where I knew my own family didn't quite understand the work I was doing, and here's this tool that'll familiarize individuals with it. So when I took the course, and I'm in Alameda County, one of the most diverse counties in the nation, and I asked the individual salespersons, I guess, at that time, and they were from Australia. That's where it was developed. If we can change out the videos to be more reflective of the communities we served, and I was told, no, we couldn't do that. And then I started working with faith communities around it, and the faith communities were saying there's something missing. And I think it was because they did not include the important role that faith and spirituality plays for individuals. So I would never say it's not a great tool. It is for layperson. And a lot of our faith leaders took the course, but then they still needed it to be a little more specific to how they see it experienced in their faith communities. So that,
okay.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So they have, I think, responded, Mental Health First Aid have responded to some of that feedback, but there's
mm-hmm.
so much that you cannot do with it to protect its fidelity that I found this mental health friendly communities model with would be more specific and designed specifically for faith and spirituality to be a little bit more culturally responsive.
Mm-hmm. And I can see that. I'm a certified mental health first aid instructor, and one of the things that they're really encouraging, and I do understand that the whole fidelity model aspect of it, is to bring resources with you that are obviously, it's a natural and community resource with the faith community. So that's something that instructors could be encouraged to bring along with them when they do have a course, that these, you know, don't forget the faith community. Don't forget where people, you know, go to worship and that sort of thing. Because very often it's a nice collaborative effort that people can make if they know that your church leaders believe in, you know, having mental health treatment and using that as you would for physical treatment. It's a great resource. So thanks for clarifying that.
No problem. Thank you for doing the mental health first aid. We need all tools. It's not one way. It's multiple ways.
Are there others on the line with questions or comments or ideas for new information?
I will share, I usually get questions around, you know, is this a violation of separation of church and state? And then when I ask individuals in the audience to give me anything they may have that said, in God you trust, no one ever reaches into their pockets and give me anything. So I think we pretty much understand that counties need to have a policy, entities need to have their own policy, and we need to follow guidelines around how to do this in a way that is not proselytizing, but it is giving individuals, you know, an opportunity to experience wellness in a way that's very meaningful for them. So a lot of the individuals who we work with do not attend a religious ceremony on Sundays or Fridays or Tuesdays or any day of the week, but they do still consider themselves to be spiritual and mindful about who they are. So a nature walk might have ranked in the top five are reading Holy Scripture or yoga. We got a wide range of feedback about what being spiritual or operating in a faith meant for individuals.
Gigi and Kelsey, this is Cindy Zimbricki. This has been a wonderful presentation, and it certainly opened up how I think about things. I think your point of looking at faith-based to be inclusive of spirituality and spirituality to be inclusive of faith-based participation is really critical, because I think for the mental health professional, as you said, the training has really kind of kept away from spirituality because it's, well, you're not supposed to talk about that kind of stuff. You know, we have our evidence-based practice, and spirituality doesn't fit into one of those. So it's a mindset that we have to help mental health service providers change additionally.
Right. And I had, they didn't tell me to take it down. I just moved on to another quote, but for a long time on my I work for the government. On my byline, I said the most important evidence-based practice is love, and the most successfully proven to be true is prayer. I mean,
yeah,
support that.
Yeah.
And we need to move from evidence-based practice a little more to practice-based evidence.
Left.
Yes.
Well, thank you for your comment question, Cindy. Anyone else on the line with a comment or question for Gigi?
I want to know how you're going to get those 50,000 ribbons out there.
I have no idea. I'm going to do my best. I usually work with transitional age youth.
Yes.
That are having a difficult time finding work, and they really
left.
Gravitate around doing this work too. When I was first doing this work, people were told me that they weren't as connected, and I started having sessions with transitional age youth. And in our county, our definition for it, or in our state, is 16, and we elevated it to 29 because some ethnic communities, they get their diagnosis so much later, and we wanted them to be included in some incentives that come with being TAE. So I do an icebreaker around music, and every one of those transition age youth used a song from their childhood that are considered gospel or faith-based songs as the song that strengthens them when they're having a difficult time. So that's when I knew that, yeah, this is important to our young folks as well.
That sounds really, really great, Gigi. Could you give some other examples how you engage transitional age youth?
Well, one of the programs I've championed for a long time is out here in California called Beach Rhymes in Life. And they do a form of hip-hop therapy. So they're urban youth. I use the terminology at promise versus at risk because I think individuals need to be encouraged and not seen as, you know, negative. I use strength-based languages. So got a small little grant, not much, and because I had such a positive experience working with the youth for the campaign last year, I had an opportunity for them to come into a studio setting and share some of the songs. And so each of them wrote a song that was around what inspires them when they're having a difficult time, but they rapped the song. And then we put it on CDs to raise money for their they're not funded by the county, so to raise money for their agency. And it's been great. It's a multi-generational approach now because those transitional age youth are going back into school settings and working with kids in special education classes and in our mental health funded school setting program. So it's really been much more than I could have ever thought of. And then also on the faith-based side, I started a program called I'm a Winner, and we had individuals, transitional age youth, that were at risk of not graduating on time. And we partnered them with some of the church members who had a commitment and wanted to make sure those young people graduated, and so they started doing an after-school type program, and it was amazing, the results, but it was really built upon them empowering the young people around what their true skill set was, because we have moved to a STEM-based approach that's frightening, as it would have been for me. Science, technology, engineering, and math were not ever my strong suits, so we put high STEM, history, and innovation, and taught the young people how important it was for them to understand the history of those subjects and that they could do it if they understood the people who created some of that. And so it was pretty successful, but, of course, the funding ended for that, but it was strong connections that have continued on, even though it's not funded anymore, with some senior retired teachers still working with transitional age youth.
Well, Gigi, that's fantastic. One maybe last question, unless others have some. We often get a question around how do I engage with faith-based leaders? And I think really what that question is where do I find them? How do I reach out to them? What do I say? And if you have any insight on just those really basic principles of how you start that first conversation with your culture brokers, that would be fantastic.
Well, I send out a letter, but I got the names from individuals in our system of care. So those consumers, that's what we, you know, refer to them as clients in Alameda County, who were connected to their faith communities, I asked them if they can make an introduction to me with the faith communities that they connect with. And then I wrote one letter. I didn't tailor make it for each community, but I put in some information about the importance of them being seen as leaders and being keepers of their flocks and able to come to that one clergy roundtable. So we had a clergy roundtable. We asked family members and consumers to connect us with their faith communities. We sent it out broadly, and I didn't order enough food because I thought maybe 30 people would show up, and it was 50.
Wow.
Because mental health is so big an issue, and I guess the letter, which I can forward to you, Kelsey, around trying to get them to come out and be the influential person in their community to make a difference for people who were living with mental health, compelled them to show up that day. Not all stuck. I mean, you know, the 50, I probably have now 20 people who I can pick up the phone and engage with that are committed, but that's really all you need to keep the movement going.
Well, fantastic. Thank you so much. And I definitely will solicit that letter from you and make it available for those on today's call with your blessing.
Sure.
If just closing out, I know that there may be others with additional questions or comments. Feel free to email me at leonardkt@upmc.edu, and I can connect you with Gigi and give you more information on how to get answers to your question or any of the materials that we presented today. We will also be emailing those out to you, so if you haven't signed in the chat box, I think we lost the chat box, but that's okay. I'll bring it back up. But just feel free to please shoot me an email to leonardkt@upmc.edu if you have any questions. Otherwise, we will be emailing the materials out to all of our
friends
and posting them on our website. So before we end today's call, just if there's any questions, comments, concerns, or announcements, we'd be happy to take them. Well, hearing none, thank you, everyone, for joining, and have a great rest of your afternoon.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Oh, thank you so much for you, too.
Thank you.
Happy for coming on.
Montgomery County.
Thank you.
Josh,
yes, Gigi, if you want to stay on, we'd love to just close out with
left.
You.
Left.
Lex.
Left.
Diana Brocious.
Left.
Jen.
Left.
Crystal.
Left.
Keyla.
Left.
Gigi Crowder.
Left.
Joe Kloss, Luzerne County.
Left.
Christina Gordon.
Left. Left.
Cindy.
Left. Left.
Wendy.
Left.
Lisa.
Left.
I guess that's it.